Should all the acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should all the acquaintance be forgot and all the lang syne? For auld lang syne, but joe, for auld lang syne, we'll tak a cup o' kindness yet for auld lang syne. We twa hae paid auld in the barn fae morning sun till dine, but the seas between us spread here o'er since all the lang syne. And we twa hae ran aboot the braes and poot the gowans fine, but we've travelled monies the weary fit since all the lang syne. For all the lang syne, my joy, for all the lang syne.
Well, with that tune, we have to say Happy New Year and good morning, everyone. We hope you're having a great start of your day, although it's almost February. But this is our first program in the new year as the Artist Experience Radio program, where we're talking about specifically visual art. We have lots of great things planned in our hour programs in this new year. We hope we can get your juice talking about art every Saturday mornings between 9 a.m. and 10 a.m. This is Tom Xenakis. I'm with Sheila Blake, and we are the hosts of the Artist Experience radio program.
Hi. Artist Experience is an hour-long radio show dedicated to looking at art. We hope that Tom and I can introduce our listeners, you, and to what we've been looking at and what we've been thinking about, and help you create in your soul, in your own experience, your own work of art. We also have an Artist Experience page on Facebook where we put images of the things we're talking about. It's also a place we'd love our listeners to give us ideas and feedback. Please look at it if you can while you're listening, especially today when we'll be describing paintings in some detail. You can also stream the program at tacomaradio.org. Also, we're putting on podcasts of this show on my website, sheilablake.com, and as on artasexperience.com, so that you can listen anytime, and the podcast can be found on iTunes.
Well, we opened the program with a poem, actually, put to music by Robert Burns, wrote the poem, a Scottish or British poet. And most of you, of course, hear this every year for a long evening at the New York New Year celebrations. But this was originally written as a poem, turned into a yearly musical classic. This work introduces our show today, which is titled Poetic Collaboration. We would like to explore the collaborative efforts in poetry and visual art. There's a rich tradition in both these two art forms. Poetry is another art form that has personally enthralled me. Poetry evokes many things visual, but poetry contains language as well, and terms that are inherent in the visual arts as well. Poetry has been with me since the second grade when I read two short poems by Robert Louis Stevenson at Assembly, my first stage performance, and this has stayed with me ever since.
We've discussed before how the visual arts are related to art forms like music, dance, theater, film, and today poetry. We've talked about composition and key and mood and emotion. There are ways of describing one art form which can be best described by using the terms of another art form, like using rhythm and tempo to discuss painting and sculpture. These swirls and whirls in Van Gogh's Starry Night, they can be described as rhythmic. Jackson Pollock's mural that's now on view at the National Gallery is all about rhythm, jazzy percussive rhythm and movement, the movement of dance. Poetry is a vast subject that's been embedded in the visual arts in so many ways. To help us with this, we have a special guest in the studio with us, Peter Blake.
That's right.
A scientist, engineer, and poem reader, an enthusiast of the written word in poetic forms. And he's also my husband, my partner in life. When I first met Peter, I got a job working for him as a house painter. I had the beginnings of a crush, and we were standing in the backyard in one of the houses we were painting in our painter's white clothes under a pear tree. And I reached up and picked these small, hard, greenish gold pears, and I put two in my hand, and I said, "Look, a Cézanne." And Peter said, "I don't know anything about art." It was a setback.
Oh, man.
But I didn't give up. So, Peter, the door opened, and now you love Cézanne and the rest of the visual arts, and you've always loved poetry. What about that relationship between the poetic word and visual art? Hey, Peter.
Hey, Sheila. Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. Yes, I remember those pears very well. I also remember the day we drove up from North Carolina to the National Gallery of Art. It was on it was open on Friday nights then, and we saw an exhibition, and we were again looking at Cézanne pears. And I said, still didn't know anything about art. I said, I don't get why Cézanne's great, but I knew that it had something to do with cones and spheres and triangles. And you said, okay, look, just look at that pear and look at it for a while, a long while, and realize that every single stroke was exactly meant by Cézanne. So I said, okay. So I'm looking, and it's a while, and I'm not bored. I'm kind of interested. And this idea that every stroke, it wasn't just slapped on there in a spirit of improvisation and joy. It was there on purpose, exactly. And all of a sudden, pow, it popped into three dimensions. And I was astounded. I looked around at the other canvases also, and they were in three dimensions. 15 minutes before, it was flat. It was completely flat. And now it's in three dimensions, and I didn't know how he did it, because it's a miracle. But I realized then I'd been given a key, a very valuable key to understanding something that I didn't understand before. And that's what you do here on this show, I think. I think every show you give your listeners a key.
Thank you for that, Peter.
Thank you.
So you asked, what do verbal poetry and visual art have in common? So it's a great answer to that. They are both expression of the imagination. That's a definition from Shelley, the English poet around 1820. He said, poetry in the most universal sense is the expression of the imagination. Okay, that needs a little bit of an unpacking in its meaning. The imagination had a full, rich meaning. The Romantics had a new theory about the nature of human progress. Before them, the Enlightenment had elevated reason to a divine status. Reason was the tool needed to analyze religious fundamentalism. They wanted to pick up society and the world, turn it around 90 degrees, like looking at a stage play from the wings, and reveal what it really was. The Romantics said, well, imagination is more important. Imagination is the human faculty that creates novelty. Everything that's new originated in imagination. Everything, science, building, technology, even ethical values, even language. Imagination created language in the beginning. And at each stage of human progress into the future, the imagination expands away from what is currently known. This will never end. There'll never be an end to new understanding. And so, the expression of the imagination appears in visual art and poetry and science. Visual art isn't just a picture that astounds us because it looks so real. No, and poetry is not propositions or wisdom dressed up in fancy language. And science is not digging down and finding truth. Science proceeds through imagination. But the thing about science is that it doesn't rest there. It's got a goal, something useful, something to build with, something to move on from, another brick in the edifice of human understanding. But art and poetry stay in the imagination. And
it communicates, you know, that imaginary act, right? You know, to the viewer, auditor. You know, you have an audience and you get to participate and linger in that imagination. Well, why don't we start, Peter, with a poem by Constantine Cavafy titled What I've Brought to Art. Cavafy was born in 1863 and he lived most of his life in Alexandria, Egypt, part of the Greek diaspora in Egypt at the time. He lived in England and a very few years in Greece, but his poems were written primarily in Greek and in English, and this is an important kind of context to what Peter had kind of opened the show with, imagination. Peter, why don't you read that poem?
Oh, thank you. I'd love to. It's called I Brought Art. I sit in a mood of reverie. I've brought to art desires and sensations, things half glimpsed, faces or lines, certain indistinct memories of unfulfilled love affairs. Let me submit to art. Art knows how to shape forms of beauty, almost imperceptibly completing life, blending impressions, blending day with day.
Thank you, Peter. This is an important poem to me in the late 1980s when I first read it. But I want our listening audience to understand that when this poem was written, the word art in the poem is capitalized. So in other words, it's important that the poet is talking about all art forms that shape creativity and hopefully our own, forming our essences as human beings. Our creativity, an essence, blends day to day, as the poet states in the last line. No matter who we are and what we do, we really, in essence, are surrounded by creativity. Okay? So, firstly, we want to discuss in this program language and vocabulary, which we often do in this program, words that are used by both art forms in visual arts and poetry. I'd like to talk about the design elements and the principles of composition and how they shape both art forms. Words like pattern, rhythm and repetition, movement, which could be graphic and, of course, poetic, tempo and cadence to the mark and to the word, and to the emotion and mood, emphasis, space, and the pause. What do they mean to be art alike? So Peter, let us start with you in the shared language between poets and visual arts. Let's start with the patterns and rhythms and repetitions so important to the visual artists.
Okay, let's start with the basic rhythm for English verse, the iambic rhythm. It flows smoothly like English country dance. The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. Shakespeare, of course, used iambic, mostly in lines of 10 syllables, iambic pentameter. This above all, to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day, thou canst not then be false to any man. Or, a horse, my kingdom for a horse.
That's Shakespeare too, right?
That's Shakespeare too, yes.
Wow.
Richard III. So, that is a continuing rhythm, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So, but the rhythm can be more complex. Here's a favorite in the anthologies from William Butler Yeats. I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honeybee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the veils of the morning to where the cricket sings. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always, night and day, I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. While I stand on the roadway or on the pavement's gray, I hear it in the deep heart's core.
Well, thank you, Peter. Well, we want our listeners to understand that in the making of art, the marks on the canvas made by a brush or fine lines made in an etching or in a drawing, the marks of a chisel on a sculptor's work carry rhythms as well, and they do that visually. You know, repetitions are inherent in the expression of developing visual arts in the part of our human condition. So rhythms and repetitions and patterns, this is part of who we are. Think about our own biology. Think about our lives and our everyday rhythms, what we do repetitively, the way we breathe, walk, talk, and chew, our heartbeats, our cycles, digestion, even gestation, for example. So we're inherently biologically in rhythm. And as an artist and educator, I often ask my students to be mindful of this biology when it comes to the physical, emotional, and possibly spiritual activity in expressing themselves creatively in a visual. I believe their expression should and could be an aid, an extension to their natural self. These rhythms in writing are an extension of a way of expressing ourselves verbally. But we can also do this without rhythm. And this is also natural for some of us. Yes, others may be not like the fact that things are out of rhythm, but certainly it's a valid way of expressing oneself. Peter, let's hear an example of this kind of expression.
Right. We were talking earlier about how a line of poetry is a breath. And a line has an end break where if there's no comma, there's a sort of a falling forward pause. You just said you said the lines in paintings had ends also where they broke was part of their beauty. Modern poems often have no specific rhythm, but they do have a pulse and a breath. Here's a complete poem by Ezra Pound. Oh, my songs, why do you look so eagerly and so curiously into people's faces? Will you find your lost dead among them?
Wow, thank you, Peter.
Peter, that was beautiful. So let's address time and cadence in poetry and art. These are important and related to rhythm and repetition. I'm going to give you a definition of time. The indefinite continued progress of existence and events in the past, present, and future, regarded as a whole. With every breath we take, every tick of the clock, we're grappling with time, the elasticity of time, how our awareness of our lives shrinks when we're pondering the vastness of eternity, or expands when we're suffering from dire pain. I'm going to try to keep it simple, though. Time, the time we give to listening to a poem or the time we give to looking at a work of art. Being late. Late for what? What's the hurry? If you've committed the time to looking at art, why rush through it with your cameras and see nothing? Do you really think you'll look at the picture on your phone and absorb the experience of looking at the real thing?
Good for you, Sheila.
Oh, man. One of the most asked questions about art, besides how much is it worth, is how long did it take to make it?
True, true.
The answer is however long it took. Paintings are about time, but the most obvious literal cliche is the Dali melted clock in his painting titled The Persistence of Memory, to the time it takes to reach the spiritual in Barnett Newman's Stations of the Cross. Time is the pauses in a poem, the rests in a piece of music, and the places in a painting to rest your eyes. Time is what it takes to accustom your eyes to a work of art, to really enter into the painting, to travel around a sculpture. There's a Van Gogh painting, Lark in the Wheat Field. It's simple. The wheat grass is blowing against the blue sky and the red-cut wheat in the foreground. The wheat and the small red flowers are tossing in the wind. The clouds are moving fast. The immediacy of the day brings you right there to 128 years ago when Van Gogh stood there painting in the wheat field.
You know, most of our listeners will be familiar with Starry Night by Vincent van Gogh. Van Gogh often presents us with hosts of rhythms and repetitions that are visually complex in the sense that he gives us the patterns, the rhythms, and repetitions in almost every kind of graphic mark possible. Van Gogh is a visual bombardment of marks, and they are usually swift and energized. Van Gogh's works are fast tempo of marks, a blitzkrieg of visual engagement. His works, in both his drawings and paintings, basically give us everything in patterns of lines, shapes, forms, colors, spaces, textures and patterns. This is everything that you can visually absorb. He hooks us in many visual ways with these patterns, rhythms, and repetitions. And this is something he does consistently well and in a very poetic way visually.
Well, I'm going to try to describe to you Van Gogh's Starry Night. Swirls and whirls and halos of yellows and whites and green and piercing blues. Stars in the night sky above the town. The cottages with light in the windows and the church steeple cutting up through the blue hills behind, through the light on the horizon. There's a twisting black-green cypress in the foreground on the left, framing the sky and guarding the town. It's painted by the artist who touched the stars.
Great. I'd just like to contemplate a little longer what you just said, that there is time in these paintings by Van Gogh. Time in a static painting. That's a miracle. If our listeners don't have the Artist Experience Facebook page open right now, after the show, go to art-as-experience.com website and look at our reproduction of Lark and the Wheatfield. You can see for yourself, and you can also see Starry Night. That was a beautiful description.
Thank you.
Well, one of the things about Starry Night, it's a lot to visually digest. So I think it's maybe we could time to take a little break here. And you are listening to WOWDLP Tacoma Park, your 94.3 on your FM station.
Suzanne takes you down to her place near the river. You can hear the boats go by, you can spend the night beside her, and you know that she's half crazy, but that's why you wanna be there. And she feeds you tea and oranges that come all the way from China, and just when you mean to tell her that you have no love to give her, then she gets you on her wavelength, and she lets the river answer that you've always been her lover. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know that she will trust you, for you've touched her perfect body with your mind. And Jesus was a sailor when he walked upon the water, and he spent a long time watching from his lonely wooden tower. And when he knew for certain only drowning men could see him, he said, all men will be sailors then until the sea shall free them. But he himself was broken long before the sky would open. Forsaken, almost human, he sank beneath your wisdom like a stone. And you want to travel with him, and you want to travel blind, and you think maybe you'll trust him, for he's touched your perfect body with his mind. Suzanne takes your hand
she leads you to the river. She is wearing rags and feathers from Salvation Army counter, and the sun pours down like honey on Our Lady of the Harbor. And she shows you where to look among the garbage and the flowers. There are heroes in the seaweed. There are children in the morning. They are leaning out for love. And they will lean that way forever while Suzanne holds the mirror. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know you can trust her, for she's touched your perfect body with her mind.
So thank you, Leonard Cohen.
Wow, that was amazing.
That was beautiful. So back to poetry and time. Another kind of time in paintings. I'm going to give you Mondrian. Mondrian was born in the Netherlands in 1872, and he moved to Paris when he was almost 40, and that was when everything was going on in Paris. Initially, his paintings, like a lot of painters, was based in nature, but over time he distilled nature to the simplest of elements: white background, primary colors, line, squares, and rectangles. And within that, he discovered movement. He said, "Art is higher than reality, and it has no direct relation to reality. To approach the spiritual in art, one will make as little use as possible of reality, because reality is opposed to the spiritual." And I want to say that it's so amazing to me how important these sort of directives are. It's great. Mondrian had always been attracted to the latest in ballroom music. He liked the tango over the waltz. In the late 1920s, he named two paintings, Foxtrot A and B, after the popular American dance. Like so many European artists, he moved to New York in 1940 to escape the war. He was 68. His last painting was Broadway Boogie Woogie and its unexpected syncopation of rhythm. It's produced visually in this painting. The most important factor in the origin of this painting and in the mutation in his art had to have been the experience of the daily rhythm of New York, the pulsating movement that animates Broadway, especially at night, and creates a harmony out of the opposition of contraries. If you can go look on our Artist Experience website, look at Broadway Boogie Woogie. So first you see a white background with yellow lines running through it. Some connecting bands of a different color bring about a change in direction and proportion. To this basic composition, he added small blocks of red, blue, and gray, and sometimes the same yellow as the traversing lines, giving the whole a new tempo and an entirely unexpected movement, a bouncing staccato rhythm. So slow down. Take your time. Let your eyes settle into the painting until the colors bounce in your eyes. Here, time enters into your experience in a different way than Van Gogh.
Yeah, absolutely, Sheila. That's a wonderful kind of comparison to the time in Mondrian to Van Gogh. And I think these parallels are really important for a poet that brings in his work into different kinds of time. And artists, of course, do that visually with their graphic marks and spaces as they're communicated on their media tablet, whether it be a canvas, a piece of paper, or a wall.
Mm. Well, like Mondrian, Kandinsky's paintings began with recognizable subjects, but with bright colors that were unrelated to the subject. He left descriptions of reality behind, moving to bright shapes and lines which are both paint and form, and they're no longer objective subjects. The paintings from this period are large, expressive, colored masses floating independently with lines and squiggles. These overlap freely to form paintings of extraordinary force. Music, That's what's behind this. Music was important to the birth of abstract art. Since music is abstract by nature, it doesn't try to represent the exterior world, but music expresses in an immediate way the inner feelings of the soul. Kandinsky sometimes used musical terms to identify his works. He called his most spontaneous paintings improvisations and described more elaborate works as compositions. So erasing the boundaries between the visual and the musical is an old game. The Pythagoreans were probably the first Westerners at it when they declared the eyes were made for astronomy, the ears for harmony, and these are sister sciences. This simple proposition was taken up by medieval sages who developed it into a vast intellectual system of arcane and convoluted theories of how music and the mathematical proportions of creation were one and the same. The Romantics had their own similar thoughts. Goethe declared that architecture was frozen music. Don't you love that? Mm. And the mid-Victorian uber aesthete Walter Pater wrote that all art aspires to the condition of music. By the late 19th and early 20th century, blurring the edges between music and the other arts had become a widespread obsession. The idea fitted with the spirit of an age when artists and commentators from Russia to America were embracing new religions, dabbling in new sciences of dreams and symbols, and grappling with excitement about the prospects for a new synthetic experience of art, where the material distinctions between word, image, and sound would melt away into a kind of spiritual, although it often seems more sexual, ecstasy that would shake the body and the world. Poems and paintings became music, and music became paintings and poems. I myself get so much pleasure from the Kandinskys that are like sonatas. There are two beauties at the Phillips collection. When he gets into a language, though, that blends the language of color and music, well, that's pure poetry. We've trained our minds to see paintings that are devoid of images, to see the language of abstraction. But is it the same for sounds and words? Can we take the meaning out of words and hear only the sounds? Can we take the beat and the melody out of music? When Kandinsky and his partner, Gabriel Münter, heard a concert of Schoenberg, it opened up a whole new freedom for them. So his late paintings were meant to reconcile the redemptive power of art's inner pulsations, meant to be experienced with all of one's senses. These paintings were exacting diagrams of the formal effect of different colors, shapes, and lines, each of which he felt had a distinctive sound, but they look to me like obscure music schematics, and they seem tedious and inexplicable, but it's just that difficult for me to listen to atonal music, and I guess that's where I am stubbornly limited.
Well, Sheila, you're bringing up a very complex thing in Kandinsky's treatise on the spiritual and art, and I think this is a very cerebral thing that kind of brings poetry and music and visual art together, and it's a huge topic. Well, the movement and tempos that we've been talking about can be created or affected in visual art by a line break, just like a punctuation in poetry. Many visual artists created great movement in their works, which can be categorized in two ways: the movement of a mark through a composition or an entire canvas, or the empty space that's sometimes called the white space in a composition. Also, the kind of mark that might show a gestural quality or rapid application of the mark with a brush or a pencil or a chisel. In other words, it's like do-do-do-do-do kind of mark on the canvas. Well, there are many artists, and we've already talked about Van Gogh, but Willem de Kooning, who we've talked about in previous programs, was also an abstract expressionist painter from Holland, and his work had an attack to it, which was kind of frenetic and energized. But there are many artists out there that had that kind of rapid pace movement. So many, many artists have different kinds of tempo. Peter, give us an example in poetry of a work that has a slower and possibly more deliberate cadence or tempo.
Okay, here's one entitled Release by A.R. Emmons. After a long, muggy, hanging day, the raindrops started so sparse, the bumblebee flew between them home.
Oh, wow. That's incredibly slowly paced and beautiful. But Peter, how about another one with a kind of a different cadence and possible punctuation?
Sure. This is interesting. Emily Dickinson, this poem of hers has a basic iambic pentameter rhythm, but is broken up by line breaks and dashes. It's broken up by emotion. This is a poem of heartbreak. I cannot live with you. It gains extra poignance for me when I think, and this is not a consensus opinion by any means, that Emily was in love, romantic love, with a woman, her best friend from her youth, who married Emily's brother. The couple moved in together next door. And I think this is referred to in the poem a little bit. He then took a mistress, quite publicly. He could take a mistress, but Emily and Susan Huntington could not be together. Emily, as is well known, took to her room, dressed only in white, the color of death, wrote poetry, did not participate in society, but nevertheless, she had vitality and wit. I cannot live with you. It would be life. And life is over there. Behind the shelf, the sexton keeps the key to putting up our life, his porcelain, like a cup discarded of the housewife, quaint or broke. A newer sever pleases, old ones crack. I could not die with you, for one must wait to shut the other's gaze down. You could not, and I? Could I stand by and see you freeze without my right of frost, death's privilege? Nor could I rise with you, because your face would put out Jesus, that new grace glow plain and foreign on my homesick eye. Except that you than he shone closer by. They judge us. How? For you served heaven, you know, or sought to. I could not. Because you saturated sight, and I had no more eyes for sordid excellence as paradise. And were you lost, I would be. Though my name rang loudest on the heavenly fame, and were you saved, and I, condemned to be where you were not, that self were hell to me. So we must meet apart, you there, I here, with just the door ajar, that oceans are, and prayer, and that white sustenance, despair.
Well, Peter, this is an amazing poem because, of course, we're looking at it and reading it in the studio, and our listeners are listening to it. But it's totally kind of broken up by these dashes. And a dash is a line, and a dash is a mark. So, in other words, this poem is very visual in its kind of biting kind of dash. It's almost like a dig in the breaks, as Peter so beautifully read that poem. And it's you know, it's knee-high deep in emotion. And I think this is a good opportunity where you were describing cadence and tempo, but also visually the poem has an incredible sense of visual break with all these dashes, which are lines. So thank you so much for that, Peter. That was great.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
So paintings and sculptures, like poems, can be the purest way to express emotion. And this is extremely important in our need to express ourselves. In our emotional condition and the human condition, emotion and art can be in the subject. And here are some examples. I'm just going to try not to make this into a list, but fear and horror, as in Picasso's Guernica. Although I myself have never felt anything for that painting, except it's a good graphic for peace marches. And Tom is going to
disagree. Oh, I'm
going to
jump on you in a few minutes.
Boy. And sorrow is in the Van Gogh drawing by that name. And in the Rock Creek Cemetery right here in Washington, there's a beautiful memorial to Clover Adams by Augustus St. Gaudens with that same name, Sorrow. And in Caravaggio's Judas beheading, Holofernes, there's resolve and there's also horror. And in the Lucretia Rembrandt, which is also in the National Gallery, is resolve and then a wistful farewell to life at the same time. And in Constable, Wivenhoe Park, Essex, there's peace. And Edvard Munch, Passion and Death. And Katakovitz, love and tenderness and the suffering of children during wartime. From a female artist that never had children herself, the power of her works are astounding. And in Bonnard, not the paintings we usually think of, but old age and isolation. And in Edward Hopper, loneliness. And William Merritt Chase, belonging to the blessed and worthy upper class. So I'm going to talk about the most hyper grandiose paintings that dwarfed everything else until the 1950s in America. Thomas Cole. Beginning in 1838, he began his five huge over-the-top landscapes titled The Journey of Man. Yikes. They depict a man's journey through his various religious endeavors. They illustrate the concept of the sublime within nature. The effects of nature depicted in paint are unbelievable. Sunrise, sunset, giant waterfalls, mountains as high as the Himalayas. The harsh reality lies in the fact that worldly elements, whether materialistic or organic, within a natural setting, do not offer the same tranquility and satisfaction that God and His kingdom can offer. This idea is laden throughout Puritan poetry, such as Anne Bradstreet's In Silent Night, When Rest I Took. So I'm going to read you the very end of that poem. Rest up thy thoughts above the sky, that dunhill mists away may fly. Thou hast a house on high erect, framed by that mighty architect, with glory richly furnished, stands permanent, though this be fled. It's purchased and paid for too by him who hath enough to do. A price so vast as it is unknown, yet by his gift is made thine own. There's wealth enough, I need no more. Farewell, my pelf, farewell, my store. The world no longer let me love, my hope and treasure lies above. So Bradstreet realizes that God is the ultimate sublime and nothing can transcend his power. And this is the same message Cole's painting gives off. Another painting, Looking Down Yosemite Valley, California, by Albert Bierstadt, is another well-known painter who is part of the Hudson River School. This depiction of grandeur illuminates the vastness and natural beauty of the Yosemite Valley. However, more than just painting, just not for the sake of focusing on aesthetics, there was a political motive behind it. These ideal landscapes were painted as a way to promote the manifest destiny. There were instances when painters from the Hudson River School were commissioned to accompany government surveyors on their expeditions of the West, and by depicting images that overcame the human mind with a sense of overwhelming grandeur that no American had laid their eyes on, they were essentially enticing the Americans and creating hype and excitement for territorial expansion. This is exactly the purpose of this painting. Images like these were not only exciting but shocking for Americans who never imagined that a sublime sight like this existed. And we don't know. I mean, the painter, in their minds, it existed. Bierstadt plays with the contrasting colors and shadows to dramatize the vastness of the valley. The light shining in the back has a godly and ethereal feel to it. It seems as if it was cleverly situated as a way to draw a parallel to the belief that Americans were destined and it was their God-given right to occupy and expand the lands.
This is so important, Sheila, and thank you for sharing that. This whole concept of manifest destiny, and it goes back to Peter's opening in the show about imagination. These guys were actually making up the stuff most of the time. And yet, you know, it was very palpable, unbelievable. Well, visual emphasis is an important in grabbing attention. An artist like Winsor Homer uses red in his oil paintings and watercolors throughout his career to catch your eye. Of course, in our consumer-obsessed culture, advertising and commerce need our attention. Visual punch and emphasis are a bombardment on the TV and the internet. We all know that. We live it every day. The element of surprise often grabs our attention. Peter, give us an example of this in poetry.
Okay, I'll read Flies by Alice Oswald, a contemporary British poet. This is the day the flies fall awake mid-sentence and lie stunned on the windowsill, shaking with speeches. Only it isn't speech, it is trembling sections of puzzlement which break off suddenly as if the questioner had been shot. This is one of those wordy days when they drop from their winter quarters in the curtains and sizzle as they fall, feeling like old cigarette butts called back to life, blown from the surface of some charred world. And somehow their wings, which are little more than flakes of dead skin, have carried them to this blackened, disembodied question. What dirt shall we visit today? What dirt shall we revisit? They lift their faces to the past and walk about a bit, trying out their broken thought machines, coming back with their used-up words. There is such a horrible, trapped buzzing wherever we fly. It's going to be impossible to think clearly now until next winter. What should we? What dirt should we?
Wow, that's intense. Well, Peter, thank you for that. Let's get another poem that might be more famous in the sense of being modernized by Simon and Garfunkel in the 1960s. And this is a poem that I actually loved actually in school. But then, you know, several musicians I knew and several other poets that I knew would also look to see, like, what kind of poetry could be actually put to music. So why don't we read Richard Cory by Edwin Arlington Robinson, who was a very enigmatic, actually, poet in his own day. But why don't we go with this one, Peter?
Great. Whenever Richard Cory went downtown, we people on the pavement looked at him. He was a gentleman from sole to crown, clean-favored and imperially slim. And he was always quietly arrayed, and he was always human when he talked. But still he fluttered pulses when he said good morning, and he glittered when he walked. And he was rich, yes, richer than a king, and admirably schooled in every grace. In fine, we thought that he was everything to make us wish that we were in his place. So on we worked and waited for the light, and went without the meat and cursed the bread. And Richard Cory, one calm summer night, went home and put a bullet through his head.
Wow, that one really gets to me. And it's about poetic emphasis and focal point, figuratively and literally with a bang. And I think, you know, Richard Cory stops right there with that last line in such power. Well, thanks for joining us, Peter. Your expertise in reading the poetry was really is really amazing.
So now that we have a little time, I wanted to tell something that happened to me. A long time ago, I went to a concert, and it was the pianist Lauren Hollander, and he had been a child prodigy. He was, when he was 11 years old, he was flying all over the world, doing his homework and reading about the different religions, and he got carpal tunnel syndrome, and that's when I heard of him. So when he started the concert, he was playing the Schubert E-flat, beautiful piece of music. And he sat down and he told a little bit about Schubert and the piece of music, which I've never heard a concert where the performer spoke to the audience. And he started the piece and then he stopped. And then he said, I'm going to take that again. And he played that piece. It was the most beautiful thing. And it's the music I want played at my funeral. I'll play it. And
you're going to play it at your own funeral?
Absolutely. That's intense. I need to be there. So, and then a while later, we saw that he was going to be speaking to the Music Teachers Association in Durham, North Carolina, where I lived. And he was speaking at North Carolina Central, which was the black college there. And we went to hear him. And he sat down at the piano and started talking about when he was a little boy. And his parents wanted him to play the violin, but he would climb up to the piano, this big box, and he'd play the middle C. And then after a while, he would play C and G. And he played them for us so that you could hear the way he heard them when he was a little kid.
Yeah, he said, Mozart said, C major was the key of happiness.
Ah, that's right. And so while he played, he talked to us about basically what we've been talking about here, music, the imagination, what it is to be creative. And he said in the end of his talk, he looked at all the music teachers, all these people who toiled in the public schools, trying to get these kids, you know, on their side, on his side, their side. And he said, what you do is so important. By teaching music, you're teaching these kids to be creative. And how else are we going to solve the immense problems of the world? And that stayed with me forever. I thought it was so beautiful and right.
Oh, absolutely. Art could help us through these things. Well, we thank Peter for joining us today, and we hope you've enjoyed the show. Sheila, just what about that next show that we're going to have?
Well, first of all, we're going to have another poetry and art show, because we could barely cover what we wanted to cover. We left out so much. And there are other shows we're going to do. We're going to definitely do a politics and art show. We have to.
Yeah, especially with things brewing in our own area here.
Yeah.
Well, you know, stay tuned for our next exciting programming here. Well, we have Bobby Hill with This Music coming up right next. A 94.3 FM Tacoma Park, and we have, you know, he's going to share so much about his incredible knowledge and musical depth, and he does it every Saturday from 10 to 1, and Avant-Garde Jazz is right here, so keep that dial fixed. And we invite you to listen to Bobby Hill at WWDLP Tacoma Park with another terrific program, Borderlines, on Wednesday mornings from 10 a.m. to noon. No borders, no lines, with great musical variety. Next Sunday, we have 8 to 10, our friend Gail Behrens, The Night Ride Home. She serves up an eclectic and selective mix of songs from a host of musical genres. Until next time, see everything, art and everything you do, and experience the visual with the rhythm of poetry as well. Have a great afternoon, everyone. Thanks.
The name. to trouble her mind, but to love and be loved by me.
I'll make my bed near the rising tide and her tomb by the sounding sea.